It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Assembly has a new committee this year focused on government efficiency. It's similar to a federal initiative created by President-elect Donald Trump, known as DOGE. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said the goal of his GOAT committee, or Government Operations, Accountability, and Transparency, is to address inefficiency in government, telling Wisconsin Eye recently.
The idea that people don't have to work in the office, the idea that agencies are just going to explode with the amount of staff that they have and the ideas of what they're working on, I think we could do a better job. I want to find ways to use technology. I want to find ways to use AI.
And to learn more about public management and efforts to streamline government, we turn to Don Kettle, professor emeritus and former dean at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy and a longtime faculty member at UW-Madison. Don, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Kate, it is so good to be with you and all my friends there in Wisconsin.
Well, can you give us a general overview of what you see in Wisconsin's new GOAT committee? Of course, it's early on. What is it? What is your initial reaction?
Well, it's an important effort for sure, but it is always much harder to pull off these ideas about improving efficiency than often appears in the press releases. And the idea that you can just take a sword and make broad cuts and save money, create efficiencies without at the same time creating lots of damage is something that's really dangerous very often. It's the sort of thing that you have to do much more with a scalpel than with an axe.
Do you think there are reasons why it's happening now?
Sure. There's really two things that I think explains it. One is that if there's anything that we learned from the 2024 election, it's that the people are very unhappy, that they think that government doesn't deliver value to them, and that this is something that is an important issue that the Republicans in particular have been successful in capitalizing on. And then in addition to that, we have the DOGE Commission with Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy working at the federal level, and they are working hard at trying to find ways of creating many of the same kinds of things. So it's a broad scale effort that the Republicans nationally are trying to capitalize on.
So do you find that from the federal level to the state level, there might be some crossover here between a state level GOAT committee and what is proposed with DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, which, as you said, would be run by Elon Musk and former Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy?
Absolutely. There's a strong connection here. The idea that the people at the state level are not reading the same newspapers that everybody else is, of course, it would be crazy. They're picking up on lots and lots of the ideas that are being generated at the federal level. And many of these things, of course, have been circulating in the background, both by conservative think tanks and, in addition to that, by the famous Project 2025 guide, which is a 900-page a monster of a book, really incredibly detailed and incredibly even heavy. You can use it to lift weights in the morning if you want, because it's 5 pounds worth of conservative ideas, which I think are extraordinarily powerful, which represent in many ways the greatest hits of the things that the conservatives have been working on for a long time. And so this is a huge effort that has been launched nationally and which is now being picked up by the states for, in many cases, the same kinds of interesting and fascinating efforts to move forward.
But in order for a committee like GOAT or DOGE to make these powerful changes, as you said, to take a sword and make broad cuts, you have to have sweeping authority. So how does a committee like GOAT, do you see, have that type of authority?
I think it's really a kind of a three-step process if you step back and think about a strategy. The first is to create a set of big ideas that you can use to try to drive it. It's a kind of investment in intellectual capital. And in many ways, a lot of it's already there. As I mentioned, not only from the conservative think tanks, but also through Project 2025. So there's a basic collection of ideas that provide a game plan. Then there are the things that you can do if governor, say, or if you can try to work things through executive action. the things that that executives can do on their own without legislative changes. And then finally, there are those things that require changes in the law. And the deeper that you get down into that three-point list, in many ways, the harder it gets, because it gets to be that much harder to build a coalition around those things. And so it's a complicated process, but it's not a single swipe. It's something that you can, in many ways, think of as a series of things that you can conceive of and then do.
So when President-elect Trump announced DOGE in November, he said in a statement that he aimed to drive out the massive waste and fraud which exists through government spending. In your analysis, is there massive waste and fraud in the federal government?
Yes and no. And in some ways, you can look through lots of items and discover lots of things that you just wish weren't being done. But wishing things that weren't being done doesn't automatically create waste and fraud. It just is a difference of political opinion about what ought to be done. If you look, though, at the same time at things like what's called improper payments, that is payments being made by the federal government for which there's not adequate documentation and which may very well constitute waste and fraud, then we have actually a pretty substantial problem. It's something that amounts to, according to the Government Accountability Office, between $200 and $400 billion a year just in that category. But the problem is that to be able to go out there and find it, you have to be able to have good detectives that are terrific at being able to use not only the current technology, but maybe even develop AI to determine which patterns of spending are the ones that we don't really have adequate documentation for, and represent people trying to sell the same wheelchairs multiple times, or creating bogus billing so that they can get reimbursed for Medicare and Medicaid and a whole collection of other things. And that requires not fewer government employees, but often more, because you need really smart people who know how to use AI as tools, people who know how to be able to root around and find those things, people who know how to be able to track down the waste and fraud and separate it from the legitimate programs. And that often requires more government employees, smarter government employees, to be able to solve these basic fundamental problems.
We're talking about Wisconsin Government Efficiency Committee forming in the State Assembly with a public administration researcher. Don Kettle is with us, professor emeritus at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy and a longtime faculty member at UW-Madison. We're going to get further into AI in just a moment, but I want to take a look here as Amazon's new 5-day in-office work week starts today for its employees. And in Wisconsin, you know, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said late last year that he plans to propose requiring state employees to return to the office as part of budget negotiations that start this month. What are the sticking points between government accountability and flexible work, and where state employees carry out their job?
And it really varies a lot. If you look at state employees, you can have, for example, the people who work in the prisons, for example. And you would not want to say, okay, remote work is okay, because those people obviously can't guard prisoners if they're sitting at home. But on the other hand, you can have people, we were just talking, for example, about AI. And much of that work can be done remotely by sitting at a computer and rooting around at what works, writing new programs, going through government records. And that work can be done from home as well. And there's actually a fair amount of research that says that at the very worst, it doesn't make things any worse. And then on the other hand, it could actually improve the efficiency and the productivity of government employees. Add to that, there is a lot of research too on top of that, that one of the things that COVID did was to give both workers a chance to be able to see how well they could work at home, and how, in particular, remote work can support two-income households, where you can find ways of taking care of the kids and do your work at the same time. And it's proven to be an effective way both of recruiting government employees and also to make sure that they are as productive as possible. If you begin forcing people to come to the office, then especially some of the very smartest people may decide, you know, I can get jobs in the private sector doing much of the same kind of work, maybe as a contractor working for government, and people may decide to leave. So it's a matter of balancing the nature of the work with the ways of trying to make work more productive, but at the same time of understanding that an important issue that we face is finding ways of recruiting and maintaining the next generation of workers as well. And for the next generation of workers, work-life balance is extraordinarily important. So that what we have is the idea of the five-day work week has become a kind of a conservative symbol about how it is that we're going to be tough on government employees, but separating how to be tough on government employees from the mission and how to ensure productivity is something that often is very difficult to try to connect.
Do you anticipate in this toughness government layoffs through these efficiency efforts? What might happen to jobs in government?
Well, first of all, one of the prime supporters of the idea of remote work has, of course, been public employee unions, and the conservatives have been interested in trying to do all they can try to weaken the power of those unions, for starters. That's one thing. Second thing is that it's an effort to try to drive some government employees away, and because there is a not too thinly veiled hope on the part of some Republicans that by making it tougher for people to work, that is to force them to come to work 5 days a week, then some people may just leave. And then ultimately there may be layoffs, because we can see a debate coming up that says, you know, we have things that government's doing that it shouldn't be doing. And the way that we can try to deal with that is maybe not by repealing the laws, but by laying off the people who are responsible for administering them. And so that the big series of issues out there, the chain of actions we can anticipate, I think are ultimately designed on one scale, at least, to try to reduce the size of government and to reduce the number of government employees.
Don, thank you so much for your insights. Thanks for joining us.
It's so good to be with you, and I wish all my friends there in Wisconsin a very happy new year.
And to you. Don Kettle is Professor Emeritus and former Dean at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, longtime faculty member at UW-Madison. We've been talking about new efforts by Republicans to address inefficiencies in government at the state and federal level. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the port of Duluth Superior is a hub for domestic and international trade. At the end of shipping season, the head of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority talks about the tons of cargo that came through.
And grain in particular is on pace for its best finish since 2021.
Shipping traffic on Lake Superior, that's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In 2023, the Port of Duluth Superior stayed open for its latest season. It marked the longest season for international shipping traffic on record, a total of 277 days. With record low ice coverage on Lake Superior, the port stayed busy with ocean-bound salties, as they're called, moving tons of cargo like grain and steel. Superior is the coldest and deepest of the Great Lakes, and it is one of the fastest warming lakes on the planet due to human-caused climate change, which is having effects on the shipping industry. So what has the 2024 shipping season been like for the Great Lakes' most western port? We check in now with Deb DeLuca, Executive Director of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. Deb, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Well, Kate, thank you for having me on the show. You know I have a soft spot in my heart for Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you. Well, let's turn to last year. Your port moved over 30 million tons of cargo across over 700 ships. That was up nearly 5% from 2022. And, you know, as 2024 comes to a close, how was shipping activity this season?
Yeah, it's a decent year. I'm going to say compared to last year, it's more of an average season. But of course, there's highlights, and we can talk about those. So, but we're watching the last few weeks of the year, see how it plays out. but we're expecting it to be a bit below last year, but an average season overall.
What were the predominant types of cargo that these ships were carrying over the season?
Well, I also have to give a plug for iron ore is always the predominant cargo in the port. Mm. You know, it's the king cargo through the terminal or through the port. And it's absolutely, you know, we're critical. The port of Duluth Superior is critical in the nation's steelmaking supply chain, the iron ore coming out of Minnesota's Iron Range. And then it goes on water to reach the steelmaking facilities on the lower lakes. It also moves through two harbors and Silver Bay as well. So just a reminder of that context. But we had a really nice, we've had a great year for exports. And grain in particular is on pace for its best finish since 2021. And it's still not back to pre-COVID levels, but it's fantastic to see that uptick. It's positive for a port and for consumers around the world who enjoy that high-quality wheat that moves from the Midwest and through our port.
What do you think is driving that uptick in exports?
Well, grain is always such a tricky commodity to make any sort of authoritative declaration about. But we've had a good harvest, for one thing. You know, oftentimes it's challenging for us to compete because our dollar has been so strong, but it probably speaks to markets elsewhere in the world, perhaps not being as competitive.
Hmm. Last year, ice coverage on Lake Superior was near record lows in January. What do you anticipate for ice coverage, and what does that look like ahead of you as the season ends and you could possibly extend a season?
Well, I can see the harbor from my window. It's still very blue out there. We had a very warmer than normal autumn. Ice is just barely starting to form. Lake Superior was at 1% ice coverage as of yesterday. Beyond that, it's hard to predict. I'm expecting it to be bigger, icier than last year. And beyond that, I don't have a crystal ball answer for you.
Sure. But what do you take into account when considering extending a shipping season?
Well, we don't actually make that determination. So the SULOCs have a set open and closing date, and that sets really the Laker season for our port. And then the Seaway also sets their date well in advance. The Seaway, which then sets the ocean-going vessel season expectations, they have been trying to extend their season a little bit the past few years. They're not going to react to more or less ice in the system at this point and extend the season.
In terms of the large ocean-going vessels and a season that is extended, can you look back to last year and give us any takeaways there?
Sure. Last year we had our longest ocean-going season. We had the earliest arrival on record, which was March 28th. That was the Federal Dart, and the latest ocean-going departure, which was on December 29th. So that was a 277-day season. This year, all the ships must be clear of the Montreal Lake Ontario section of the St. Lawrence Seaway by noon on January 5th. Of course, that's next year, 2025. In normal conditions, it's about a five-day sail from Duluth Superior to Montreal. So ocean-going vessels will depart Duluth Superior by December 31st. They are most likely to leave sooner in order to allow for the unexpected.
I wonder, in general, Deb, would a longer shipping season boost economic benefits for the port? Does that at all have an impact?
Well, certainly, the more vessels, you know, the longer the season, the more vessels in and out. And a key element is that most of the customers that use this as a supply chain know what to expect from the season opening and closing. But that little bit of extra length to the season means that they can plan to get one more, let's say, import or export vessel in and out of here before the season closes. And that certainty to plan around is, and certainty around an extended season would have, I'd say, of course, add to economic impact.
Are there efforts to improve efficiencies at the port that could help to meet the demands, you know, now and in the future for if you are faced with longer shipping seasons, for instance?
Oh, that's a great question. The season's been a little longer. You know, the ocean-going season has been a little longer the last couple of years. And, you know, efficiencies, we're always seeking for increased efficiencies and productivity at all of the terminals. But in reality, this isn't a port like, let's say, Houston, where you have a vessel in and out every few hours. Mm-hmm. So you need to plan and make sure that the timing and is right and that the berths are open. And that's generally not the situation here. So it's not that's not as much of an issue from an operation standpoint.
So you mentioned Houston, a huge port, and that brings me back to during the pandemic, the supply chain bottlenecks we saw, you know, ports like Los Angeles that were just going 24/7 to alleviate all of that shipping congestion. And I'm wondering, has your port or other Great Lakes ports helped to alleviate any shipping congestions by routing through you after that cargo crisis we saw during the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a great question. And a really thorough answer would be complicated and take up well beyond your show length. But I can say that, yeah, absolutely. During COVID, we saw huge supply chain disruptions that have really carried forth to today. Like they've had ongoing impacts. And there were a number, shippers were looking at our system, the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway system, as a possible pressure relief valve to at least take some of the pressure off a portion of their supply chain needs. And some of that has continued on. At the same time, COVID also saw in our region, the closure of some, big shipping customers that use this port. So in one particular, for instance, was Verso, the paper plant that was here in Duluth. So we've seen, in our own terminal, which is the Clear Public Marine Terminal, it's the one general and break bulk terminal in the harbor. In other words, we're the one terminal in the harbor that gets the cargo that you lift with cranes and the heavy lift cargo. So and we also handle containers on water. It's the only terminal in the port that does. So what we saw during COVID was that a lot of shippers could not get access to containers to get their goods into the middle of the country or out of the middle of the country. And our agent who operates our terminal helped those shippers charter vessels to bring their goods in the holds of ships instead, in bulk in the holds of ships. And so some of those customers shifted to that mode of transport and still use sort of a blended solution today.
Ah, so you're seeing some of those customers sticking around.
Yes, or sticking to that mode of transportation.
Sure.
The hallmark of, the hallmark of our terminal is that we have these flexible supply chain options. We can move goods, by vessel or by rail or by any number of options. So yes, we've had a number of customers who've continued to use that option. And what's actually helped that develop even further is that we subsequently started a regular liner service between Antwerp and Duluth. That liner service also stops at Cleveland. And so what that means is there's a vessel coming on a regular schedule. You can parcel it out. You don't need to fill the entire vessel. If you're a shipper, you can just use part of the vessel. And you can get your stuff into the middle of the continent on a regular basis.
So you mean between you and Belgium?
Yes, between Antwerp, Belgium, and Duluth, and it stops at Cleveland as well, and that's been a very successful endeavor. Again, I think that we know that regular schedule is key to the success of that liner, we have had cargoes that come into Duluth and go as far away as the Pacific Northwest, and also come from as far away as Alberta to go through our port on that service.
We're talking about the Great Lakes shipping season as it comes to a close with Deb DeLuca, Duluth Superior Port Executive Director. Deb, as you think about all of the different machines and, heavy lifting cranes to move this cargo, there are some seaports that are really trying to work on reducing their carbon emissions in their operations, you know, maybe moving off of diesel or other fossil fuels to power their, port activities. Are there efforts to create cleaner operations in the Great Lakes ports?
Yeah, absolutely. I should mention that the Port of Duluth Superior and the Duluth Seaway Port Authority, we're members of the American Great Lakes Ports Association, which represents the U.S. the port authorities on the U.S. side of that of the Great Lakes. We're all interested in pursuing lower carbon emissions. As you might expect, it costs a lot of money, and you don't just do it randomly, right? So we actually had a climate action plan prepared for our terminal this year that it lays out, it identifies the best routes, in other words, the lowest fruit to the lowest hanging fruit to the highest hanging fruit to go after to reduce our carbon emissions, and lays out a plan for us to be zero emissions by 2050.
As you look at that plan, what will be your biggest challenges that you'll be grappling with?
Money. Honestly, money. We have a great, our utility. We're served by Minnesota Power. They are already, I believe, well above, they're at 50% renewable already. So we have, a good green electron source here. But we first need, we need to, for instance, in our case, we'll go after a certain portion of our lift equipment first and the charging equipment to go with that, and then move on from there. But we need to be able to capitalize that.
Are there federal grants that could help along the way?
There was a Clean Ports grant that was put out by the US EPA that was funded under the Inflation Reduction Act with $3 billion. And unfortunately, they put that all out in one big grant round because it took a while to get it out, and they were in a hurry to get it out, understandably. But we competed we put in a statewide application for Minnesota through the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And unfortunately, we were not successful. So we will continue to seek grant funding opportunities as they're available. And then we just have to schedule the purchases, the capital into the future. But there are other opportunities out there.
It is that season of reflections and goal setting. What do you most look forward to in your 2025 port operations?
Well, I'm going to speak first to the liner service, because not only we started that, not this shipping season, but last shipping season. And what we found is we had enough sort of base speed cargo coming out of the Mediterranean that we have almost a secondary liner service. Well, it is a secondary liner service. It isn't quite as regular coming out of the Mediterranean. It comes all the way into Duluth. So looking forward, we are planning on ways to expand the use of that service. We're looking at connecting with other ports on the West Coast, for instance, we have lots of plans up our sleeve.
With that diversification, and say a liner, whether the liner you have is going to Belgium or you have activity in the Mediterranean Sea, does that expand the type of cargo that you see moving through the port?
I'm going to say yes, and we hope so to a greater extent. I mean, it really should. Although, again, couch that in, this is the liner service that comes to our terminal. We handle the general and break bulk cargo containers. We can also load some of those vessels have a very flexible holds structure and can potentially also be loaded with grain to come in for another terminal as well.
So during the season, in the winter season, when you're not seeing these, you know, big salties and other cargo vessels moving through your port, where do large freighters go during the winter months?
The Lakers have to go. It's their opportunity to get their maintenance done. And they have, you know, they all have a specific maintenance schedule that they need to maintain and a 5-year schedule that they need to hit. And so those ships go for layup at various places around the lake, at lakes, I should say. And we have right here at our terminal, we have 3 vessels coming in for layup. And I know there's other ones that are coming to our port, but I don't know what terminals we will know, but I don't know yet what terminals they are.
And so these ships will go in for all sorts of maintenance during these more dormant months when they are not carrying cargo.
Yeah, and it's, you know, for our region, that's significant workforce benefit too. Fraser Shipyard is right over on the Superior side. They are, a key ship builder in the Great Lakes, and they do a lot of maintenance. So the ships that are here at our terminal, those will be Fraser personnel coming over here to do, and other tradespeople throughout the region coming to do the work on the vessels.
Well, Deb, it's good to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us. We, you know, I appreciate your interest in the port.
That was Deb DeLuca, Executive Director of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. We talked recently about the close of the 2024 shipping season and other port initiatives coming up in this new year. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, we visit Wisconsin folk schools where people learn traditional skills from woodworking to weaving and get to know their neighbors.
A folk school is about community. It's about bringing people together. Sometimes in some communities, it's the center of town.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The folk school movement was founded almost 200 years ago in Denmark and spread to the United States in the early 1900s. The schools aimed to build community and to help people learn a wide variety of traditional crafts and skills. And Wisconsin is no stranger to the folk school concept. Wisconsinites can choose from a handful of schools offering lessons in traditional folk dance, music, crafts, and food, and then passing those traditions on to new generations. We're going to hear from 2 of those schools now. One was established over 50 years ago in southwestern Wisconsin, but first, a folk school in the making. In November, the Superior City Council approved plans for the Superior Craft School. Jeff Dorfman is the president and founder of the school and hopes to start classes by next fall. He talked with Rob Ferret last week.
What first got you interested in the craft school concept, Jeff?
Well, there's a folk school up in Grand Marais, Minnesota called the North House Folk School. And I have gone up there and taken classes, and you know, they're right on the shores of Lake Superior, the North Shore. And I always thought, geez, you know, why can't Superior have something like this? For a number of reasons, you know, the Duluth Superior area is the, you know, the most western port on Lake Superior. And not only is a folk school about community, but it brings people from outside the area into the community. And for about, I don't know, 10 or 12 years, I just thought, got to be cool if somebody would start one in Superior. And I don't know, one day I you know what? No one else is stepping up to the plate, so maybe I ought to take a shot at it. So I called the Entrepreneur Fund in Duluth. One of their directors, Mike Lattery, is a good friend of mine, and said, "Hey, I need to write a business plan." And so I worked on that for a year with one of their business advisors, and we wrote a plan, a business plan.
Now, for people not familiar, what happens in a folk school? What's the whole deal?
A folk school offers classes in traditional skill sets, such as, you know, sewing, art, you know, quilt making. We'll have a teaching kitchen, baking, cooking, specialty classes and, you know, walking into the woods and finding plants that are edible and turning them into a dish to eat. It's about keeping, woodworking, wood carving, timber frame, joinery, classes, anything you can think of, music, photography, videography, but more importantly, they started the folk school movement started really in the early 1900s. It came over from Scandinavian countries, and it was about, through the industrial age where things were becoming automated, there was a movement where they didn't want the old school sets to die off and then nobody'd remember how to, work with their hands and like basket weaving, a lot of that's automated. But today, to do a basket by hand it's a lot of fun and it's interesting and it's very intricate and it's artistic. And that's what a folk school is about. And a folk school is about community. It's about bringing people together. It's a place sometimes in some communities, it's the center of town. In Grand Marais, which is a community of, maybe 3,500 people, that school's been up there for, I think, 27 years, and they are literally now the identity of that community. You can't miss it when you drive into Grand Marais. It's right there on the shores of Lake Superior, and if you want to take a class there, you're coming from outside the area, it supports their service industry, restaurants and hotel rooms and Airbnb rooms. It has a significant economic impact on that community. And that's what we want to do here, is bring people together and offer classes that are interesting and unique. And that's what it's about.
Jeff, something I'm wondering, part of what you've got to do, of course, is get instructors to teach these skills. I could see it going a couple different ways. One is, hey, maybe these skills are few and far between. People are busy. It's going to be pulling teeth. On the other hand, when I think about people I know who know how to do this kind of stuff, they love nothing more than sharing their knowledge and wisdom with other people. What's your experience like when it comes to recruiting instructors?
Initially we will try to, keep our costs down. We will try to find, local and regional instructors, which it's not hard to find for the type of classes that we're going to offer initially. And then, you do have specialty classes, let's say like in knife making, there's Finnish knife, the Finnish knife making is, there's a number of instructors that come over. They go sort of like on tour in the summertime. They'll come to the U.S. and you try to get on their schedule, the class may cost a little bit more because the school has to pay their transportation costs and put them up overnight. But they have a following, and there's a lot of different skill sets like that. But most of our classes will be taught from local and regional instructors. When you start investigating it, you find out that there's a lot of talented people in your backyard, it's just like every day I run across somebody that's got a skill that, hey, would you be interested in teaching a class and that thing that they're special in?
And Jeff, you've cleared some hurdles so far. What has to happen between now and when we open up for classes?
Well, we're a nonprofit. We have a board of directors. The city of Superior and the city council has approved some economic development money, and then the state of Wisconsin has approved a state grant to that'll go towards the reconstruction of the building that we want to put the school in. And so we're just in the middle of financing the other part of it now. So hopefully that'll be concluded in the next couple months, and then we'll be under construction and hopefully, you know, start offering classes near the end of the summer or early fall.
All right. Well, Jeff, smooth sailing to you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Jeff Dorfman is the president and founder of the Superior Craft School, which plans, as we heard, to open in late summer or early fall of 2025 in Superior. Now let's talk with the leader of a Wisconsin folk school that's been around for more than 50 years. Terry Van Orman is executive director of Folklore Village, that was founded in 1971 in Ridgeway by Jane Farwell. Van Orman is on the board of directors of the Folk Education Association of America. Terry, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
I'm really happy to be here with you.
Can you give us the origin story of Folklore Village? How did it get started?
Well, it's quite long, but our founder's name was Jane Farwell, and she was a farm girl from Ridgeway. And she had some very unusual experiences in her life that led her to folk dancing. And she moved off to Germany, lived there for 10 years, and then moved back to Ridgeway, where an old one-room schoolhouse on her family farm was for sale. And she purchased it with the idea of starting a community group. They would meet once a week for potlucks and a social and dancing to records. And then she also taught the farm kids in the community how to folk dance, putting them in touch with their folk roots, if you will.
And I was looking at your course offerings now. Things have grown a lot. It's not just folk dancing anymore. Could you talk about how Folklore Village has grown and offered so many different folk classes?
Well, it was really organic the way that it grew. I think that Jane was in the right place at the right time in the 70s when the interest was really lively about folk traditions and particularly ethnic practices from other countries. And so she was very charismatic, and she attracted a group of several people around her who basically kind of organically from the ground up helped her plan these events and pull them off. And, from that came what we call festivals. They're not what most people think of festivals, but they're weekend long events where they're ethnically themed, and there's interchange between the artists and the participants in music and dance and craft and foodways. And there's often the wearing of traditional costuming, which is really fun. And then in 1986, the organization, all those kids who are now growing up and have families, they kind of banded together. They figured they needed a bigger space than that old one-room schoolhouse. And they started raising money to build our now main activity center, which is called Farwell Hall.
Give us a sense of the range of the sorts of classes we could take in the craft school there.
In a given year, you could take maybe blacksmithing, embroidery, weaving, building musical instruments like gourd banjos or harps, foodways classes, herbs, natural dyeing, baskets, mosaics, spoon carving. And once you would sign up, you would come for the class. Say it's a one-day class. That would happen on a Saturday. You would come in the morning. You would meet your teacher. You would get started in your class. At noon, we then break for lunch, a shared lunch. And that lasts for an hour. And so people have an opportunity to get to meet other people that are taking the other classes in that session. So you don't necessarily just sit with your new friends that you've just made in your class, but you can make other friends as well. And then at 1 o'clock, everybody goes back and works for another 3 hours. We find that break in the middle is really important for people to sort of digest all the intense learning that's happening. And then after the class, that evening at 6 o'clock, we have a potluck. And then a barn dance that all the folk school students and all the folk school instructors, as well as the general public, can attend. So even more opportunity to sit with people, have a meal, talk, and then dance together to live string band, then go home at the end of the evening. So it's a really fun, intense, but beautiful day of sharing.
Wow. What you just said there, it sounds like a lot of community building going on there.
You know, you can use any kind of vehicle to build community, but this sort of model is a really great way to do it. You know, the international dance phenomena that started in late 1800s that Jane Farwell, our founder, was a part of in the 1930s and on, you know, it was kind of founded on the premise of if you dance somebody else's dances, if you make their crafts, if you play their music or listen to their music, if you eat their food and you wear their costumes, that will engender world understanding, which is really idealistic. But in a way, when you sit at a table with somebody, maybe you're different. Maybe you come from different political backgrounds. Maybe you come from different religious backgrounds or ethnic backgrounds, but you share this one love. And that brings you together. And I think it's really important for people to do that.
Do you see a hunger for that?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, just being on the Folk Education Association of America, we've seen an amazing growth in folk schools. Before about 2010, there were 10 folk schools in the United States. After that, from between 2010 and the start of the pandemic, the number doubled. And now there's over 100. And Jeff sounds like he's going to make that 101 or however many there are now. So people are really feeling the need to have community. And then there's the other aspect of high tech, high touch. When our world gets overly technocrized, I guess. You know, you really want to do something with your hands that you can touch and feel, and it's a sensual experience rather than just a one-dimensional visual experience through a screen.
Terry, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Terry Van Orman is the executive director of Folklore Village. That's a folk school founded in 1971 near Ridgeway in the rolling hills of southwestern Wisconsin. We also heard from Jeff Dorfman, the president and founder of the Superior Craft School, which plans to open this year. They talked last week with Rob Ferret. Is there a traditional craft that you participate in, or have you taken classes at a folk school? Tell us about your experiences. Tell us how you got started and what keeps you doing that craft. Email wisconsintoday at WPR.org. That's wisconsintoday at WPR.org. I hope you can join us for a mouth-watering segment tomorrow. We'll be hearing about a neighborhood restaurant in Menasha that prides itself on serving up authentic Chicago-style hoagies, which got us thinking, who doesn't love a good sandwich, right? According to a recent survey, the grilled cheese is America's favorite, followed closely behind by a chicken sandwich. So what is your favorite sandwich? Do you find it at a sub shop near you, or maybe you stack it in your own kitchen? Here's what I wonder. Do you add chips inside for that extra crunch? Email your story about the perfect sandwich. You got it. We'll relish it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232 on your dream sandwich. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.